Hi, I'm Connie Dover, and you're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Good morning. It's Monday morning, and my name is Beth Pike. Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. On today's edition, our host, Margo Patterson, talks with Mary Kay O'Malley, professor of law at UMKC, and her assistant, Kayla Scratafil, a graduate of Youth Court, and Omari Tatum, who is presently a youth attorney in the Kansas City Youth Court. Then, in the second half of our show, host Craig LeBeau talks with Bennett Magnuson, executive director of Kansas Appleseed, a nonpartisan justice center dedicated to helping vulnerable and excluded Kansans with legal assistance, as well as advocating for systemic solutions to unjust legislation. And then stay tuned for the calendar events in the middle of the show and the 420 drug war news at the end of the show. But up next is Margo and her guest after these messages.
This is Margo Patterson with Jaws of Justice Radio. Youth courts across the country are adjudicating minor offenses by juveniles, with young people acting as prosecutor, defending attorney, judge, and often jury. Here to talk to us today about what youth court is and how it got started is Mary Kay O'Malley, professor of law at UMKC and the legal director of Kansas City Youth Court, her assistant, Kayla Scratafil, a law student at UMKC and a former participant in Kansas City's youth court, and Omari Tatum, a current member of the Kansas City Youth Court and a sophomore at African-Centered College Preparatory Academy in Kansas City. Professor O'Malley, Kayla Omari, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Professor O'Malley, could you give us a little background on youth court, how it got started, and what the purpose of it is?
Well, in 1990, a group of concerned judges and lawyers got together to talk about an alternative to the formal juvenile court system for a number of at-risk youth. There had been an uptick in juvenile crime in the previous decade, and there was some concern that these young offenders were being brought into the system, and perhaps it wasn't the best way to deal with them. So they got together and they decided to create a youth court program, and that was a kind of a national movement towards this idea of using youth to adjudicate offending youth, with the idea that adolescents tend to listen to other adolescents, plus they can relate to each other with some of the factors that lead to kids getting in trouble, such as peer pressure and wanting to fit in and things like that. So they got together, and they also looked at the idea of possibly encouraging a lot of high-risk youth to join the court as lawyers so that they could learn about the system, and hopefully by their involvement in a pro-social type of activity that it would actually encourage them to see the long picture, the big picture of what my life should be or could be, if long as I do what I'm supposed to be doing and go to school and set goals for myself. So in 1990, this was established. The Kansas City Youth Court was established and set at the UMKC School of Law.
And what are the kind of offenses that are dealt with in youth court?
Well, they're low-level, minor, generally minor misdemeanors, and usually involving first-time offenders. So we are dealing with a lot of shoplifting, minor assaults, fights between kids, trespassing, marijuana possession of alcohol, tobacco, anything that kids are not supposed to have. We have been seeing some, because our local juvenile court, the Jackson County Family Court, has now started a diversion program where they're diverting more and more of their youth to a diversion rather than going through the formal process. We have seen some might be considered a little bit more serious, like, but still are low level among the list of crimes, like joyriding in a stolen car or something along that line. But in general, we stay with those, the shoplifting, the marijuana possession, trespassing, and assault. Those are our big offenses.
And how do the offenders get referred to your to the youth court?
For the most part, by the Kansas City Police Department. When they, we have an agreement with them, and they look over the, when they encounter a situation and apprehend a youth for some violation, then they will look at it, determine based on their contacts with that youth previously whether it's appropriate to send to youth court, and they'll refer it directly to us rather than the juvenile office. There are some times that the police department refers matters to the juvenile office, but then the juvenile office makes the decision that it's appropriate for us. And the idea behind this is there's a couple advantages when you think about it. First of all, the youth gets the opportunity to come in, be held accountable, and make their amends through their sentencing that's provided by the youth court judges, and then put this matter behind them and not be concerned that, you know, they've irreparably harmed their relationship with their community, their school, or whatever. The other thing is we operate it at nighttime, so that tends to be more family friendly in terms of working folk and how they can get to the court and take care of the matters. 99% of our cases are resolved at the first hearing, which is an arraignment hearing, so they don't have to come back. So there's a lot of built-in conveniences there for the parents and for the youth as well. And then, of course, we're not even talking about the opportunities it provides to the attorneys who come forward. This is their community service. Most of them have requirements for community service at school. So this counts for that, and they come forward, and they're learning and ability to assist other kids in their community. So we kind of look at it as kids helping other kids for a better community.
Well, you mentioned some advantages of going to youth court as opposed to juvenile court. And is that, is there something, a record made if you go to juvenile court that isn't if you go to youth court, or?
Well, yes, this is kind of their one-time get-out-of-jail card. In other words, they don't start a formal record with the juvenile authorities. Are they aware of it, of the child that's been referred? Only because they're wanting to know what types of crimes. The juvenile officer obviously has an interest in what juvenile crime is occurring in his, within his jurisdiction, and so, or her jurisdiction. So, they do kind of a, we do have to provide some information or numbers to them, but it's not for record keeping on that individual juvenile, so they're not entered into their system.
Omari and Kayla, I want to bring you all to, in. How did you two happen to get involved with youth court? And Omari, why don't I start with you, because you're currently on the youth court.
I got involved with youth court. One day, we was actually finishing map testing, and I was done with my work, so I was going through our school website, and I seen a link that said apply to be a youth attorney. So when I later on in my future, I plan to be a politician. So I thought that this will set me up to further my political.
And Kayla, you are Professor O'Malley's assistant, I understand, and you are currently a law student at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and a former member of youth court. What brought you into youth court?
I've known Professor O'Malley the majority of my life, and I had heard about this program that she ran right when I started high school, and it seems that once you start high school, you start thinking about college. So I started considering what I wanted to do with the rest of my life, and being an attorney was one of the options. So I got involved with the program so I could try it out and see if I liked it, and ended up loving it so much I decided to go to law school.
And what did you like about it?
I think there are a lot of different advantages to it that led me to my decision to go to law school. One of the main advantages being that I was able to volunteer for something for 4 years of my life, and it was so rewarding and fulfilling that I knew I could get paid to do it for the rest of my life. And the experience on the youth court was just able to give me a unique way to give back to my community, even as just a 14, 15, 16-year-old. I felt like I was doing community service that meant something.
And Omari, I understand that you went through the training last year, and so this year will really be the first year that you're acting as a lawyer in youth court. Right. What was the training like?
It was very enjoyable. It was food there. when we first got there, they went over the whole program, and how can I explain it? Makes you feel like what you're about to get involved is you're going to change. Like, you're going to change the community. So the training was nice. We got to
go over a couple of laws. I actually learned some rights that I didn't know before. So it was,
can you give us an example of a right that you learned that you didn't know that you had?
Our Miranda rights. That you have the right to remain silent. I thought when a police officer contacts you in any way, shape, or form, you must apply, which you should, but then technically you don't.
And Kayla and Professor O'Malley, you all can jump in too. Tell us a little bit more about the training. Like, how much training does a youth lawyer have to have before he stands up and defends somebody or prosecutes somebody in youth court?
Well, the formal training is about 12 to 15 hours total, but then that doesn't count all their time in court doing their observation and working with other attorneys, experienced attorneys. We generally, if we see a student that's struggling, we don't like anyone to fail out of youth court generally, especially because we're looking to have an impact on that young person's life in a positive way. So if we see someone struggling with some of the information, we will pair them for quite a while with a more experienced attorney that we feel can help them, their learning process on the job without the being alone and responsible for, say, the defendant. And we'll also tend to let them represent the state a little bit more because they don't have to go through the interview process, et cetera, until they build up their skills in negotiating pleas and everything else. But that's a very few minority. Usually our kids come in and we're really amazed by their depth of their understanding of what the seriousness of what they're doing and also the laws that are involved and the people.
I had a lot of experience with training the attorneys as well as the judges. And I think one of the biggest things that we try to focus on is not only the substantive learning, like Omari was talking about, learning the laws and how our legal system operates, but also learning how to think in a critical way that's going to impact the decisions. There's a lot of things to consider when you're an attorney, whether it's prosecuting defense or you're a judge, and their different position requires you to think differently. And we try to teach them the skills that are going to help them to succeed not only in youth court, but also thinking analytically for the rest of their lives.
Well, I'm kind of putting you on the spot, but could you give me an example of how, if you're the defending attorney or the prosecuting attorney, you might have to think differently about, you know, the law or what to do in those circumstances?
Right. Well, as the prosecuting attorney, your job is to represent the state of Missouri in the best interests of the general public in Missouri. As the defense attorney, you're supposed to represent the best interests of your client. So that in and of itself is going to lead you to look at the different facts differently, try to explain the situation. When you're a defense attorney, a lot of times you get the kids who come in, and like Omari said, they don't know their rights, they don't know the legal system, and it's your job to help navigate them through that. And so being able to have a focus on your client and explain things in a way to someone who might not understand it is a really big part in client advocacy versus the state of Missouri, you're just the prosecuting attorney representing the best interests of the community.
What are the kinds of sentences that youth court hands out?
You want to talk about that, Omari?
It mainly focuses on the judge, what type of judge you're dealing with. You can get community service hours. You can verbal apology, written apology, essay, things along that line.
Well, and do you ever get unrepentant defendants?
Oh, yeah. We've had some we've had some interesting evenings in court with defendants or youth offenders that are, you know, throwing a fit, saying, I'm not going to do all of that. I'm not doing any of it. And then sometimes they've calmed down before they leave the court. We talk to them, and I send the defense counsel out to talk to them and find out what's going on here. You kind of have a situation often, too, where kids have admitted, but then they get in court and they don't want to really say that in front of their parents because I don't know exactly how they've explained all of this to their parents. So then went through the questioning from the judge. They're struggling with trying to say something at the same time. So yes, we get that issue. We unfortunately also get the issue with the parents being a problem, angry that their kid has been called in and, you know, totally on the wrong target and not concerned in a way. And it's led to a lot of, you know, kind of meaningful conversations with the youth on the court because many of them, you know, most of them have pretty supportive parents in a lot of ways, academically, socially, et cetera. And say, like Amari here, I mean, some of the stuff he may be exposed to as he goes forward in the court will be pretty eye-opening and surprising to him because it's going to be so different than his own life experience at that age.
And what are some of the, when you say that, what are some of the, what's some of the information that might be eye-opening to students who serve on the court?
Well, first of all, I think seeing parents behave that way in a public setting, their child's been called into a formal program. I mean, as I tell them every time we start a court session, this is not kiddie court. This is a real deal. This is the community responding to a juvenile who has done something to offend against the community. So, that it's time that the young people understand and know that there comes a point in their life where the decisions they're making, their parents can't fix the consequences any longer. It's now beyond the parents' control because they can't stop the store from prosecuting or charging a fee for the loss prevention against the parent because of what happened with the young person. So, you know, it's time for them to realize that the older they get, the decisions they make, the consequences get bigger and they get more serious and have more serious long-lasting effects on their lives. So, such say getting to college or getting jobs, et cetera. So, I think just being exposed to some of that, and that's eye-opening for our youth who are pretty much prompted by their parents to do what's right and to be involved in the community. Amari, for example, sits here and talks about his lifelong goal. I mean, right now he's got an eye on a long-term goal. A lot of these kids don't because they don't see anything that's positive for them. So I just think the exposure to that, and especially from some of the adults and some of the issues is pretty important. I do want to say, I've got an opportunity, I'm assistant. We are a combat-funded program, and I think combat funds us for two reasons. One, because we're a community-based program that, based on the Office of Juvenile Justice Delinquency Prevention, which is part of the Department of Justice, Federal Department of Justice, that we are model programs dealing with substance abuse issues. Because kids that get in trouble, so you could, child that's willing to go out and steal from a store is likely to make other bad decisions such as using drugs and alcohol. So, and I think the other reason that they fund us besides the fact that we're a model program, but we are a community-based program that has shown some success with both our, the delinquents who come in front of us, the offenders, but also with the groups of students who have been our attorneys through the years. So.
This is Marco Patterson with Jaws of Justice Radio, and if you're just tuning in, I'm here talking to law professor Mary Kay O'Malley, who is legal director of Kansas City Youth Court, Kayla Cratafil, and Omari Tatum. Professor O'Malley, you were talking about substance abuse. What percentage of the offenses that come before youth court are related to drug or alcohol abuse?
Well, we primarily see in Kansas City Youth Court, we primarily see marijuana possession. I'd say it's about 20 to 25% at least of what we're dealing with. And what's concerning about that is it's possession in the schools for a large part. That's where the kids are caught. And so, you know, what are students doing during the school day? How are they influencing others? Are they selling and passing this on? We don't know. But we just know that that's part of the problems that come to us, is that a lot of times it's done in the schools. And we've had such young children involved in that, that you have to worry that someone is asking them or is exploiting them in some way. But, you know, we're a community-based program meant to deal with individuals on a single basis. So those bigger problems are, you know, I talk a lot with other community leaders, such as the juvenile office, about ways to handle if we're seeing trends or seeing things that are very concerning. The police department and I both have spoken with the juvenile office about, you know, other initiatives and what they should do and kinds of cases or way we approach the matters that come before us.
Omari, I know you may have to leave a few minutes early. What do you feel you've learned from being involved in youth court?
Like I said, I learned some rights, but I also learned some personal things, being more of a model. I know once you're an attorney, it's some things you can and can't do. So I've learned how to, and not only just rise myself up, but also bring in other people. Like some of my friends I hang out with, when they do certain things, I know how to, I can somewhat teach them how to do better or another route than what they're doing.
I'm curious whether you often have, you know, the people who are either serving as lawyers or as judges in youth court, whether they often just disagree with the law that they're being asked to uphold.
That's been a really big struggle with us recently when we were training the judges and the attorneys, is we've seen a trend towards the legalization of marijuana in other states, which in the other states there's still a 21-year-old age limit for it, but a lot of studies are coming out showing that marijuana is not necessarily bad for you and all of these different things that are really, it's really confusing for our attorneys to advocate for the law because despite their own personal beliefs or any scientific studies or what any other states are doing, in Missouri, it is still illegal. So that's what we try to focus on, is that there's conflicting information being fed to you guys, and it's difficult to sit there and tell kids that what, you know, some scientific research is showing is not true, but at the same time, this is the law in Missouri. It is still the law in a lot of other states, and unfortunately, you know, we're in Missouri, and so we need to uphold that law and try to communicate with our best efforts the reasons why that law is still in place.
Well, I want to possibly get back to that, but Professor O'Malley, I know you have to go soon, and I have one last question, which is, I understand, you know, there are hundreds of youth courts across the country, but they are not all set up on the same model. What are the different models, and is there any data to suggest that one model is better than another?
I really don't know about data to suggest one's better than another. I think it's more a preference for the jurisdiction that you're involved in. So some models operate where adults are the decision makers, but youth come in and train to act as attorneys and work with the offending youth and also representing state, but an adult sits and makes decisions. Some models use a youth judge model like we do, where we have young people judging and making the decisions as to guilt or innocence, as well as what the appropriate sentence should be. And then you have some that use a model where they use a youth jury, a jury system, but they still populate it with youth. And I know, such as in Johnson County, Kansas, that they use that model, and they use prior offenders. That's part of their sentencing, is that they have to sit on a youth court jury, I believe. So, there are various ways to do it. We found, or we like, happen to prefer the youth judge model.
And why?
Well, because the development of the individuals who act as judges, first of all, obviously when they have to make the decision rather than someone else, that it leads to a different process of thinking rather than trying to get 12 people to agree to a certain, on a certain point. The other thing is that in terms of development and talking as they train new judges, it allows that one-on-one conversation where they've had the personal responsibility and they can share what they've learned about that and things to think about. But we also do, when we have a trial, which is fairly rare, but when we do have one, we ask all the lawyers to sit as an advisory panel. And that's partly for a training purpose that we think. Kayla and I have discussed this, as have the other staff members, and we think that that's a good way to provide ongoing training, is to have a real case matter in front of them rather than a mock hearing, where they also get to weigh in with their observations and their thoughts based on what they've seen and heard from the young person throughout the course of the case. So that's just the model that we use. I know Independence and Eastern Jackson County use that model. I believe Raytown Police Department, Lee Summit Police Department, and Grandview Police Departments also operate their own youth courts, and I suspect those are probably the adult model, but while I've had some conversation with them, not a lot about their procedures or their system.
And how many cases a year does Kansas City Youth Court decide?
Generally, we're between 120 and 130. That's been our pattern. That doesn't mean that's how many we get it referred to us. We do have, you know, we deal with a population that can be pretty transient at times, a certain portion of the youth that are referred to us. And so we can lose track of them, we send mail to them to set them up for court, and it returns no such address, et cetera. So we have, and then there's always a certain percentage that just don't respond to us. We have to refer anything that we cannot find, any family we can't find or don't respond to us, we refer back to the juvenile office for follow-up by the juvenile court system.
Well, we were talking a little bit a while ago about how often somebody who's a defendant may not be very enthusiastic about the sentence. How do you go about enforcing that? And Professor O'Malley, I understand you have to leave. Thank you so much for being here.
You're welcome.
We'll continue talking with Kayla and Omari. But how do you go about enforcing that if you've got a defendant who is, you know, railing at the sentence, says he or she is not going to accept it?
Right. A lot of our court is driven on the idea that we want the youth offenders to hold themselves accountable for their actions rather than trying to enforce the sentence by a stick means. We try to carrot it to them and show what the benefits they're going to get out of the program if they do complete. So if they complete and they don't reoffend by the time they turn 17, which is the legal age of criminality in Missouri, it goes off their record. They don't have to put it on job applications. They don't have to put it on college applications. We try to sit there and have a conversation with them about their goals for the rest of their lives, what they want to do, and what they need to do to achieve those goals. And oftentimes these kids are coming in with these big dreams, and we have to just show them the reality of that. If you want to be an architect, no one's going to want to hire a criminal to design their building. If you want to be a teacher, they're going to do background checks on you. We try to show them more the positive of completing the program rather than the negative of not completing, if that makes sense.
Yes, and I'm curious, what would you say has been perhaps maybe the most interesting case that you've been involved with? Obviously, you wouldn't use names.
Right. But. There are some cases that come before you that just shock you and really make it hard to see the black and white difference and kind of explain to you or demonstrate to you the way law is very much an area of gray. I remember specifically this one case that I had, which I actually wrote my law school personal statement about, was the first time I realized the law was gray when we had this young woman in our court for possession of marijuana. And when her defense attorney asked why she did it, she explained that she did it so she wouldn't harm herself. And hearing something like that, where this girl's doing the best that she can, but also by illegal means, it's hard to sit back and tell her what she's doing is wrong when she seems to be picking the lesser of two evils. So it, some of the things just shock you and make you question, you know, exactly what you believe and exactly the reason the laws are in place.
And Kayla, you mentioned that you have found your involvement in this program very rewarding. Mm-hmm. In what ways?
In a ton of different ways. Through my time as an attorney and a judge, like I said, it was the most unique service opportunity I've ever had. With my time as the assistant director, I have been trying to make it the most positive experience possible for not only the defendants who come through, but as well as the attorneys and the judges. This program was what made me realize I wanted to be an attorney, and it was because of the positive experience I had in my time as an attorney, so I'm trying to make it as positive as possible for the volunteers and the defendants we have now.
Well, Omari, Kayla, thank you so much for being with us and talking to us about youth court. Up next is the calendar.
This is the Jaws of Justice calendar for August 31st, 2015. Missouri will be executing Roderick Nunley on Tuesday, September 1st, and the Kansas City Chapter of Missourians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty will hold their execution watch from 5 to 6 p.m. at a new location, the corner of 39th and Troops, Kansas City, Missouri. The KC Chapter of Missourians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty will hold their monthly meeting after the execution watch, September 1st, from 6:30 to 8 p.m. at St. James Parish, 39th and Troops, Kansas City, Missouri. Mothers in Charge KC will have their membership meeting from 5 to 6 p.m. on Tuesday, September 3rd, at the Robert J. Mohart Multipurpose Center, Suite 124 West, 3200 Wayne Avenue, Kansas City, Missouri. If you would like to become a member or are looking for more information, you can find them on the web at www.kcmothersincharge.org or call them at 816-912-2601. The Kansas City Chapter of Empower Missouri's First Friday Forum will be Friday, September 4th, 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Westport Flea Market, 817 Westport Road, Kansas City, Missouri. This month's guest is Jacob Botch, Program Manager at Metropolitan Lutheran Ministries. He will discuss wages, garnishments, taxes, debts, regulation, and more. The KC Area Chapter of Parents of Murdered Children and Other Survivors of Homicide will hold their monthly meeting Friday, September 4th, beginning at 7:30 p.m. at Our Lady of Sorrows Church, 2552 Gillum Road, Kansas City, Missouri. Parents of murdered children meet to provide support and assistance to all survivors of homicide victims while working to create a world free of murder. My name is Keith Brownhill, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org.
And you're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. I'm Beth Pike, and I invite you to listen in next week to Jaws of Justice Radio, when our host Melvin Merritt will be talking with the folks at Restoration House. And that's a faith-based, long-term residential program for survivors of sex trafficking. And then after that, Jeff Humfeld will talk with Lahara Smith of the KC Freedom Project about the recent hearing the Justice Department held to look into the KCPD and Jackson County Prosecutor's citizens' complaint processes. But now it's going to be Craig and his guest.
Okay, this is Craig Lubo, and you're listening to Jaws of Justice Radio. Today we are going to be talking about an organization called Kansas Appleseed and what they do. My guest today is Bennett Magnuson. He is the executive director of Kansas Appleseed, which is a nonprofit organization which advocates for policies that reduce causes and effects of poverty on Kansas families. Prior to joining this organization, Bennett had led juvenile justice advocacy for the Texas Criminal Justice Coalition and served as a staff attorney for the Texas Access to Justice Commission. He has done pro bono work, including immigration criminal cases, public housing, domestic violence, and family law cases. While working in Texas, Bennett founded PRISMS, which is now called Freehand Arts Project, a writing program for inmates in Texas jails. Welcome, Bennett.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
And on that note, before we get into what Kansas Appleseed is doing, I'm interested, I'd like to hear a little bit about the arts project that you organized when you were in Texas.
Yeah, so at the time I was volunteering at the local jail, and I was teaching financial literacy classes in the evenings, and I was talking to the jail staff, the folks who run the volunteer programs. And we were just sort of, chatting outside one day and talking about just how powerful art can be, especially when people have experienced trauma in their life and they're trying to sort out a lot of difficult things in their life. And so we were sort of talking about what that might look like for people in a jail or a prison. To have an opportunity to express themselves, to communicate, and really tap into the power of art to allow us to connect to each other and to work through things on a pretty deep level. And so I just started teaching poetry classes in the evening at the jail, and as you would imagine, some pretty incredible conversations and really incredible poems as people talked about what was important to them in their lives. And then while I was teaching that class, I would occasionally run into writers in the community and talk to them about this class, and it just had an incredible response. And so within a couple of years, there were probably about 10 writers from the community who were coming in teaching a class once a week. So we had about two classes a day, every day, everything from memoirs to poetry to short stories, just a really incredible opportunity.
All right. Is there anything like that in Kansas? And if not, do you have any plans to establish something similar to that?
Oh, I would love to start something like that in Kansas. In fact, so the Freehands Art Project started in Austin, Texas, and then one of the volunteers ended up moving up to Dallas, and so she started having conversations with the jail there about starting a program. I mean, because the great thing is, if you've got some writers who are willing to donate their time, you can get a program like that started pretty fast. So, yeah, I would absolutely love to bring that. Really, it's really an incredible opportunity. And, you know, so I was a poetry major in college, and it was really great to get to read some of the poems that I remember reading in class, reading them with people at the jail, and really seeing things in the poem I had never seen before. You know, there's that poem about the daffodils dancing that I don't think I had always ever connected to until talking to people in the class at the jail as they sort of described what it is that they think about when they're sitting in a jail cell without much to do and not much beauty to look at and to remember back to that memory that brings them a little joy.
Right.
Really incredible opportunity.
In terms of the Kansas Appleseed organization, first of all, I saw on your website a lot of the people connected and board members. And it was an impressive list, a lot of attorneys that I know and some judges, et cetera. What is the mission of Kansas Appleseed?
Yeah, so Kansas Appleseed, we're working to build a Kansas that's full of prosperous, inclusive, and just communities. That's our vision. And the way we want to contribute to that is by championing laws and policies that support vulnerable and excluded Kansas. So we're a policy advocacy group. We are focusing on ways that we can contribute the expertise of the legal community and other professionals to build better laws and policies that can hopefully solve some of these problems once and for all as a companion to efforts like legal aid and similar programs that provide immediate direct assistance. We want to work with efforts like that to try to solve things on a system-wide level. So that means that we spend a lot of time investigating social, economic, political injustice in Kansas. We spend a lot of time collaborating with community partners to find the solutions and to really all of us working together to pull towards a solution. And then we spend a lot of our time advocating, talking with policymakers, making sure that we're enacting fair laws and policies in Kansas that promote inclusion and that alleviate poverty.
Do you have anybody who works with the legislature as a lobbyist?
We don't have any lobbyists on staff, but all of us, you know, regularly communicate with legislators, really to let them know what it is that our research is finding. You know, we try to make sure that we have a good ear to the ground and that we've done that research that I mentioned into the problems that people have brought to us. So we do spend a lot of time making sure that the committees in the legislature are up to speed. You know, we may come and offer testimony on an issue of juvenile justice, for example, or let people know what the impact of policy changes are going to be when it comes to, say, childhood hunger. You know, Kansas this year adopted some legislation that, unfortunately, I think is going to move us in the wrong direction. I think it's going to make more kids go hungry, which is too bad. But on the juvenile justice side, I think we're actually making progress. I think over the past couple of years, some legislation and some administration policies have really supported some better alternatives to incarceration for kids in Kansas.
And so I assume that would include not sending as many juveniles to the youth centers then?
Yeah, that's right. You know, there's fortunately been a lot of research over the past 10, 20 years on alternatives to incarceration. I mean, not surprisingly, if you just lock a kid up, say, for 6 months, chances are that kid gets out, they're probably not going back to school, and the odds are that they will end up back in a jail cell, you know, within 6 months, a year, certainly within 3 years. So that's the bad news. But the good news is that researchers have looked into this, found out that although incarceration doesn't work, a lot of other things really do. and it depends on what the specific risks of a kid are, what their specific needs are. But some really incredible programs like functional family therapy or multi-systemic therapy, you know, programs that work with the whole family, work with the community, make sure that, you know, the kid has the support and the skills they need. Programs like aggression replacement training, which is a really incredible curriculum that helps kids gain the skills they need to let go of anger. One of the most powerful experiences I had working in Texas on juvenile justice reform was talking to a youth who had gone through the full juvenile justice system in Texas, gone through the juvenile prisons, and I asked him what had been the most valuable part of that process for him, and he said aggression replacement training. And talking to him, you could tell just what it meant for him to have the skills to let go of his anger. I mean, as you can imagine, it's pretty miserable walking through life angry and not having any skills, any ability to let go of that anger. And, you know, it's even more scary and stressful when you're a kid and you have anger, you know. And a lot of the kids in the juvenile justice system do have anger, a lot of times from stuff in their family and their community life. But talking to him, you could almost visibly see, you know, that a weight had been lifted off him. It's really incredible, some of the programs that they've developed as an alternative to just putting a kid behind bars.
And would it be fair to say, when some of the authorities use the term youth center, that so that people out there know what we're really talking about, it's really a euphemism for a juvenile prison?
Yep. So there are juvenile prisons in Kansas. There are also non-secure, sometimes called group homes. Technical term is a youth residential center. Those are out-of-home placements, but they're not, you know, they're not secure. They're not cells. So there's a variety in Kansas of what the actual facility looks like. Unfortunately, some recent research in Kansas suggests that those non-secure out-of-home placements, on average, and again, there are going to be some good ones, some bad ones, but on average, they're not helping kids at all, and we're just spending a lot of money to take a kid out of his home, out of his community, and not really providing any meaningful solution for the kid or the community.
All right. And for those of you who are just joining us, you are listening to Jaws of Justice Radio. This is Craig Lubo. I have Bennett Magnuson is my guest from Kansas Appleseed. Bennett, besides working with the kids on juvenile issues, I see your organization also has worked with immigrants and on the immigration issue. What do you do on that issue?
Our work on immigration advocacy is really designed to make sure that Kansas remains a welcoming state for everyone. You know, Kansas has a very great history in terms of welcoming people who have chosen to make Kansas their home, and we think that that has brought a lot of benefits to Kansas. We know that economies are stronger when they are welcoming of immigrants. We know that our culture, our communities, everything is better when we're welcoming. And I think the experience of other states that have gone in a different direction and become very hostile and hateful have seen the opposite. Alabama, Arizona, these are states that enacted very harsh anti-immigrant legislation, and it was a disaster for their economy and for their culture. We focus a lot on immigration issues that intersect with kids' issues, education issues as well. So, for example, Kansas was one of the first states to enact what's often called a DREAM Act, legislation that allows undocumented immigrants who have graduated from a Kansas high school. Often they came to Kansas when they were very young, and they've grown up in our communities and attended schools from a young age in Kansas. And the legislation, the DREAM Act, allows those students, when they graduate high school, to attend a Kansas university and pay the in-state tuition rate, which can make all the difference for these kids. I mean, you can imagine if you put yourself in their shoes. You worked very hard in high school, often against very difficult odds, to get good grades, make sure that you're ready to go to college. You want to pursue the American dream, But if you don't have the money for out-of-state tuition, and if in-state tuition is available for you, you really have nowhere to turn. So Kansas, a little over 10 years ago, was one of the first states to recognize this, recognize the contribution that these students are making to our state, and so passed a law that said these students, if they graduate from Kansas high schools and are accepted into the Kansas universities, they are welcome, and we acknowledge them as our residents, and they can pay in-state tuition. It's a pretty straightforward policy, has a lot of benefits for our state, but unfortunately, there have been a lot of efforts to repeal it. So back in 2005, Chris Kobach, who at the time was just an attorney and working in a law school, sued the state of Kansas, claiming that this law was constitutional. Several members of the Kansas Appleseed Board intervened in that lawsuit to protect the policy and ultimately won. But what he wasn't able to do through his lawsuit against the state of Kansas, Chris Kobach has really ever since tried to do through legislation. And pretty much every year there's an attempt in the Kansas legislature to repeal the Kansas Dream Act, including this year. There was another effort. So fortunately, you know, through a lot of hard work from a lot of advocacy organizations and a lot of students themselves speaking up, talking about how important this policy is for them, what they're planning to do with their education, past students who have benefited from this policy talking about how their college education allowed them to go on to bigger and better things and really contribute to Kansas and this country. Those efforts to defend the policy have been successful, but, you know, really, pretty much every year, there's an attempt to repeal it. So we remain really focused on that, but we also want to make sure that we're not losing sight of the bigger picture, which is that sometimes these fights can get really nasty, and some of the rhetoric can be very ugly. But we want to stay focused on the good news, you know, which is that Kansas has a great history of being a welcoming state and been a It's been good for Kansas. It's been good for our families and communities, and we just need to stand up and make sure it stays that way.
What are you doing in terms of the judicial system?
Kansas Appleseed is born out of the legal community, and because of that, as attorneys, we feel a special responsibility to make sure that courts remain a place of justice for people in the community. We want to make sure that our judicial system remains fair, open to all, independent. And that means that we look at everything from judicial selection. We know that when judges are elected and have to run like politicians, then our courts are less independent. And if somebody walks into that court, they don't know whether they're getting a fair shake or whether, you know, the campaign contributions and the political election is going to influence the judge's decision. So we fight pretty hard for what's called a merit selection of judges. Right now in Kansas, it's in our Constitution that our Supreme Court judges are selected that way, where a broad group committee goes through applications. It's a very open, transparent process, selects the top three candidates for an open position on our Supreme Court, and then the governor from those three selects the new justice. So we think that process has served Kansas very well and make sure that our Supreme Court is very professional, they're experts at what they do, and that they're independent. They're not being selected because they ran a political campaign, took a lot of political donations, put up a lot of ads, and then won a seat on the Supreme Court. And actually, the reason why Kansas has that in our Constitution is because of a big scandal about 50 years ago where the governor at the time, through some kind of cheap political tricks, he had just lost an election, so he resigned and got himself appointed to the Supreme Court by his lieutenant governor. So we know that that process didn't go well last time, and that voters of Kansas about 50, 60 years ago decided that it was important enough to put it in our Constitution that we wanted our Supreme Court to be independent and professional. So we're continuing to defend that. There's been, over the past several years, constitutional amendments put forward in our legislature that would move us away from that merit selection process to a political process where judges would be under political influence. And unfortunately, at the appellate level in Kansas a few years ago, those efforts were successful. And so, unfortunately, our appellate judges are no longer selected through a merit selection process. They're selected through what you might call the New Jersey or the federal model, where the governor makes appointments and the Senate confirms. It's a very political process.
All right. We just have a couple minutes left. First of all, would you give out your website so that people who want to get some more information can go to that?
Absolutely. It's www.kansasappleseed.org.
Apparently, you use a lot of attorneys that do pro bono work. So if somebody wants to, any attorneys want to become involved, what would be the process for them to get involved in your organization?
You know, the best way for people to get involved is to visit our website. My contact information is on our website. People should feel free to pick up the phone and give me a call or send me an email. If anybody who cares about these issues and wants to get involved, we can definitely use the support.
All right. And I want to thank you for being with us. For those who just joined us, you were listening to Bennett Magnuson. This is Craig Lubow. This was Jaws of Justice Radio, and he was talking about the organization called Kansas Appleseed. So thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
It's the 420 Drug War News. The following is Jack Cole, chairman of the Board of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition.
I spent 26 years in the New Jersey State Police. 14 of those years I worked undercover in narcotics. I retired a detective lieutenant from that job. But when I retired, I felt very bad about my role in implementing what today I feel is not only a failed war on drugs, it's far worse. It's a self-perpetuating and constantly expanding policy disaster. And there's no way to fix it. There's no way to patch it up or repair it. We got to end it. We got to end it like we ended alcohol prohibition in 1933. When I went in the state police, it was 1964. I went into narcotics in 1970. When I joined the state police in 1964, we had 1,700 troopers and we had a 7-man narcotic unit. Always seemed perfectly adequate for the job we needed to do. 6 years later, we had exactly the same numbers. And it was adequate because when we started the war on drugs, we really didn't have much of a drug problem in the United States. What little drug problem we did have was mainly soft drugs, drugs like marijuana, hashish, some LSD, psilocybin, the mushrooms, the mind-bending drugs. You know, the hard drugs, such as heroin, cocaine, methamphetamine, were virtually unheard of back then. And if you go back and you look at the statistics from 1970, you'll see that the likelihood of anybody dying that year in the United States as a result of the drug culture was less than the likelihood of them dying from falling down the steps in their own house. It was less than the likelihood of them dying from choking to death on their own food at dinner. But we started a war on drugs. So you got to wonder, what was really the purpose behind this, right? In October of that year, thanks to this funding policy from the federal government, we went from a 7-man narcotic unit to a 76-person narcotic bureau overnight, all paid for by the feds. And this was replicated across the whole United States. Now think about that. When you increase the number of cops with one job to do by 11 times its size, you set up a great deal of expectation. Expectation with us in that coming year was that we were going to make at least 11 times more drug arrests than we did the year before, and we were literally off to the races. That's how this thing became a numbers game with the police. It's all about numbers.
Law Enforcement Against Prohibition website, leap.cc, DeanBecker, drugtruth.net.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and guest of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes and podcasts on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. If you have a show idea or want to help produce Jaws of Justice Radio, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live and find podcasts of our show on the KKFI website, that is kkfi.org. We thank our engineer Beth Pike for her work today. My name is Melvin Merritt, asking you to tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Tell Somebody with Tom Claymer on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Beautician Blues with Luscious Lynn, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Ho. Stick around for jazz and blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day with the spicy Latin sounds of Sabor Latino and Fiesta Musical.